Garcia, Mr. Sullivan.
If it may please the court, just by way of organization, since there's two of us, I'll basically be addressing the sufficiency issue and the one sentencing issue, as the sentencing issue only applies to my client, Mr. Hinojosa. One of the most perhaps telling pieces, and it's not evidence, about the government's acknowledgement that there is major sufficiency issues with their case is a statement made by the prosecutor, the U.S. attorney, the government, at closing argument, and he just very simple, quick words, he noted to the jury, "Well, to be honest with you, nobody knows exactly why the defendants were there, what the defendants were there for." And we start with that because the case the government attempts to put on in this case is really comprised of two elements to show guilt. The first one is a piece of evidence that since they were going to Houston, why would they not constantly be traveling south from the south to the north? And apparently when they were seen, at times they were arrested, they were moving in other directions on this piece of property, it's a ranch. Our response to that is a circumstance that happens to every person when they travel, and it shows nothing about whether or not you are dealing in any type of drugs despite the presence of drugs.
So everybody wanders around through locked gates on their way to Houston?
I think a lot of people do that may be trying to get to Houston illegally. I don't think everyone that deals drugs does or does not deal drugs would do that. I don't think that's necessarily attached.
What do you make of the knowledge of the code or the ability to open the gate?
I would say that is their most significant fact to try to show guilt.
Well, and that they walked to the hidden stash.
Well, and here's why I would say that's not a very substantial figure, Your Honor. And that is that you have this piece of property to walk around in. I think the evidence makes it abundantly clear these stashes were very well hidden. And because you have, therefore, having to walk toward them becomes of less significance. If there was some way you could see that they were marijuana, some type of packaging. But once again, my understanding, my best reading of the record, is that these were things you could not see. Quite literally, what the government ends up with is the old mere presence at a place where drugs were. This drug happened to be marijuana. Never touched it, never got close to it, never moved any of it. They went into a gate that was locked. People might do that in this area. And the fact that they happen to be traveling south when the moment comes when these officers see them is really all they have. And we submit to court with that.
I mean, they also have these guys telling a story that's not consistent with any of the evidence. We're walking to Houston. When they're 350 miles from Houston, they don't have many. I mean, these people who testified are very familiar with what unlawful aliens may be, how they may be attired, how they may be supplied, and so on. And they were not that way. They weren't attired the way others might be in that circumstance. They didn't have the gear. They didn't have any of that kind of stuff. So all of that, I mean, if you tell a lie, that can imply guilty knowledge. And so all of that put together, maybe one by itself isn't enough, but it's more than just, oh, they weren't close to Houston.
But we would submit, you say a lie. A lie certainly gives us insight into their criminal intent, but in a way, and certainly in many ways, that lie isn't a lie, what I would call a lie per se. It certainly is something that happens, even if they're ill-equipped for travel, even if they're temporarily going the wrong way, it is still possible that they are on their way to Mexico. Excuse me, a wrong country, Houston. I apologize, Ron. Excuse me.
Okay, but we just have to find evidence sufficient for a rational juror to find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. We don't have to eliminate every possibility that could be out there. So it's possible that they really were on their way to Houston despite X, Y, Z, and Q, but I don't think we can say a rational juror had to find they were on their way to Houston as undocumented aliens or whatever.
And I hope I can at least assume as my answer, this is the recent case of Vargas Ocampo. The case which dealt with, and I would, as I understand it, this court's made it clear now, the only question under legal sufficiency is whether that finding of guilt was so unsupportable as to fall below the threshold of bare rationality, as I understand the court's question, and I believe the recent case on point. And we submit under that case that problem is still here.
Mr. Sullivan, I don't want to interrupt you, except that you have a little bit of time left, and you probably want to turn to your sentencing issue.
Your Honor, briefly, and hopefully I'll get a chance to come back to it a little bit at rebuttal, one of the things that I think really this last sentencing issue turns on is the judge made it clear, I am finding there is no assault here. And the government correctly points out in a footnote that nobody gives a definition of assault. But it's irrelevant because the court clearly stated, my reasoning is based on the fact that there is no assault, and our position is that is one of the elements that had to be proven and had to be proven. And it was a critical 2 pages, and I think I wrote the 2 pages out. I think one of the things the government – I did not mean to interrupt the court. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I think what she was saying is that the shove alone would have been enough for the assault. But he said shrug, not shove, although I think he may have said shove. But anyway, so she has to look broader, and there was more to it than just shrug, shrug, shove. That's how I read that. Not that she thought you don't need an assault.
As I recollect it, there was and in fact, on the judge's part, an excellent discussion of was this a shrug or was this a shove? And her reasoning was certainly that what she understood to be a shrug would not have been an assault.
By itself.
By itself. I agree, Your Honor.
There's more, and then that's what she goes on to talk about.
In that next phrase, I don't have the exact phrase in front of me, I do apologize, but my recollection of that next phrase was something to the effect of, that's not the relevant issue. The relevant issue came down to a showing that ultimately this guy got hit by a branch or by him that turned the tide, regardless of whether or not you could label it as an assault. I think I'm done, and I went over my time.
Your initial time has expired, and you've saved time for rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Tinoco?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Francisco Tinoco, and I represent defendant appellant in this case, Mr. Jose Villalma Garcia. However, as you understand, the arguments made by us right now are equally applicable to Jesus Gonzalez Hinojosa, who is the co-defendant, co-appellant in this case. I've been charged with discussing the second major issue in this case, which involves what we will call the 13th juror.
Okay, and I just want to understand this. Did anybody who actually tried the case say that when the verdict was returned, there was a 13th juror that walked out with everybody and sat in the box and was part of the group that returned the verdict?
Your Honor, I, as well as my colleagues, have gone through the record completely several times, and no one at any point on the record indicated that.
No, I'm just asking, like, somebody was there. I mean, in other words, the jurors leave, the 13 people leave, and there's not a dismissal of the 13th person on the record. I get that. It is easily and likely the case that they walked in the hallway, the bailiff took the 13 jurors aside, said, thank you very much for your service, give me your badge, goodbye, get your parking stamp downstairs. All right. But once the jury returned a verdict, they come back. And then it would have been obvious whether there's 12 or 13, and the time for an objection and so forth would have been appropriate. Did anybody who was actually there say, whoa, what is this alternate doing here and what happened? We want to explore what happened with him or her.
Your Honor, again, on the record, there is nothing, no conversation, no statement that was made by either by the judge, by the U.S. attorney, or by defense trial counsel.
All we know is that the 13 left the courtroom. We have no evidence whatsoever that the 13 deliberated and that the 13th juror was still there when the verdict returned.
That's correct, Your Honor. But the evidence on the record indicates that the 13th juror was part of this proceeding. And that is the evidence that is before us.
You have nothing to show what happened after they walk in the hallway or walk towards the jury room.
Your Honor, I'm limited by the record in this case.
I mean, you don't even have an affidavit from somebody saying I was there and I saw the person, you know, come back out or, I mean, nothing.
Your Honor, my understanding is that I am limited by this court as to the record on this case. I can tell the court that I did have, in the course of my due diligence of this case, I did talk to the defense trial counsel, and they did inform me that there was a 13th juror. However, that is not part of the record.
That returned the verdict?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And why didn't they object?
Your Honor, I can't tell you. I wasn't defense counsel. I can't tell you why that happened. But again, my hands are tied by the record.
Yeah, I mean, you're correct. I mean, you're dealing with the record, and we appreciate that because oftentimes counsel try to go outside, and you've been careful about doing that.
Yes, Your Honor. And what is the significance? The significance is that we have an extra person in this scenario, which literally undermines the long history and sanctity of our trial by jury system and calls into question the fundamental fairness of our legal system. A trial by jury of our peers is a fundamental bedrock of our legal system and one which should be treated with the utmost care by the courts. This issue here is about the 13th man or woman. Now, if we were talking about Texas A&M football, that wouldn't be such a bad thing. A number sanctioned by tradition, a number sanctioned by history. Here we are talking about such an important legal norm as fairness, due process, constitutional rights, and non-waivable rights. The right to a trial by jury of one's peers is a constitutional right that such jury be composed of 12 peers, free of any outside intrusion or influence, is a benchmark of our legal system, one which has wholly engraved in the psyche of the general public, a notion also marked by tradition and history that is reflected by Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure, Rule 24C, as well as something that has been protected in the past by this court in U.S. v. Allison and what the U.S. Supreme Court discussed in U.S. v. Olano, as well as sister courts throughout the nation, including the sites that we have in our brief indicating that the First, Sixth, and Seventh Circuit have also analyzed this issue. As such, I know this court understands that the juries play an integral role in our legal system and that the protection of the sanctity of our jury system is important to this court as well as to the Supreme Court. And as this court stated in U.S. v. Allison, and I quote, it is essential that alternate jurors do not deliberate because once the prescribed number of jurors becomes the jury, then and immediately, any other persons are strangers to its proceedings. Their presence destroys the sanctity of the jury, and a mistrial is necessary. So in U.S. v. Allison, this court indicated that a mistrial was the adequate remedy because of that extra person. And the record in this case also indicates that there existed a limited number of prospective jurors available for this trial. That is, there were issues in the way that the case that the jury was impaneled, so they had a limited number of jurors that were available, and that's why they only ended up with one alternate juror in this case, because after the back and forth, there was only one extra person available to serve as an alternate juror, and that is part of the record. The record also reflects that all members of the jury, including the alternate juror, were part of jury deliberations. The record indicates that the alternate juror was never released, and the record reflects that the alternate juror was therefore a member of jury deliberations. We don't know if that person was a jury foreman, to what extent they participated, to what extent they may have chilled any participation by the other members, to what extent they may have been considered a third wheel and affected the conversation or deliberations of the jury panel. The only thing that we know is...
We don't know if they just sat there or if they left.
That's correct, Your Honor. But we do have the instructions of the trial judge indicating that they were instructed to deliberate with all members of the jury. That was the instruction given by the trial judge. The trial judge did not say, alternate jurors, don't discuss, don't participate. You stay outside in the hallway while everyone else participates. They were instructed to deliberate. And as the Supreme Court has indicated, there's a presumption that jurors do what they are told by a judge.
All right, so narrow down to what is in the record. What is there in the record that tells us for sure that there was an extra juror?
The record indicates that a jury was impaneled, that there were 12 members of that jury, there was an alternate juror that was part of that proceeding, and that all 13 were part of the entire two-day jury trial, that when it came time to delivering the instructions to the jury, all 13 members were there, that all jury members were released to deliberate, that all jury members returned with a decision.
Wait a minute. Where in the record does it show that all 13 returned with a verdict?
It indicates that the jury came back with a decision. The decision was read by the foreman.
Okay. Is there? We know that the judge dismissed the jury or said go deliberate. Right. I don't mean dismissed, but told the jury to go deliberate.
That's correct.
But is there anything more specific that tells us that more than 12 went into the jury room and participated in the destruction? Or we're just assuming that from the fact that the judge didn't specifically tell the alternate in open court, you can go home now.
That's correct, but there was also no discussion or no statement made to the effect that alternates, you alternate person, you may not participate.
Right.
You may not deliberate.
But counsel, your entire argument is not based on what is in the record. It's based on what's not, because all we're talking about, frankly, is there is no statement in the record where the judge said, at least on the record, that the 13th juror was being released. That's all we're talking about. And if that statement were on the record, then you wouldn't be here arguing that point, right?
I'm not sure if we would still be arguing that point with the court. There is no statement.
Well, what I'm saying is if there were a statement on the record which said that the 13th juror was released, because your entire argument is based on the fact that there is no such statement. You don't have anybody who says there was a 13th juror in the deliberations. No affidavit from the attorney. No objection. I'm guessing any lawyer can count up to 13 if they got a law license. So 13 people walk back in and the verdict is read aloud and I got enough time to look over and count. And what we have here is, like we don't have the judge releasing the 13th juror, we don't have anybody saying there were 13 people coming back with a verdict. And so just like when you said you and your argument, and you correctly stated it abound by the record, you understand that we are as well in terms of what's there. And all we have is the absence of a statement releasing the juror.
Yes, Your Honor, but I would also state that there is no statement saying you are released, something that something that would be normally found in these jury proceedings, something that would be put on the record. In fact, the U.S. Attorney's Office has indicated that that is something that they're surprised by as well, but it could have happened in a different part, different conversation. But I believe the court is also bound by the record. There is no statement saying 13th juror, you are released.
All right. I believe your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Wilson?
May it please the court. There's ample evidence to support the jury's verdict here. The jury rightfully believed that the defendants were not hapless immigrants who had stumbled upon the enormous amount of marijuana on the Garcia Ranch. As this court has already noted, there was evidence in relation to Mr. Vilma having the combination lock characteristics missing that are normally associated with smuggling.
Well, but the other thing we didn't mention is that they had family nearby.
Well, I was going to mention that, yes,
so
Your Honor.
Like
6 miles away. They lived 6 miles away. Also, the marijuana could be smelled in the area because obviously there was quite a bit of it. In addition, it was worth $5 million when you consider all four areas, the Alpha through the Beta, Charlie, and Delta, as well as the fact that Mr. Vilma told Mr. Gonzalez to stick to his story, that they clearly had a plan if they got caught. So there were some other things as well, and one of the things that the agents had seen is when the gentlemen were delivered, the pickup truck, had been driving south. So all these indications were such that this was not a typical alien smuggling operation by any stretch of the imagination. Counsel had mentioned the comment during closing argument about not knowing exactly why the defendants were there. However, if the court were to read that, I think that with all due deference to counsel, that's taken out of context somewhat. What he was talking about is you never essentially know what somebody is doing when you can't see them. I think that's the context of it. However, regardless, arguments are not evidence. The district court always instructs a jury to that effect, and there's plenty of evidence here. So there's no indication whatsoever that some stray comment a prosecutor made affected the verdict in any way. Likewise, these mere presence cases don't apply for the same reasons because the defendant's connections weren't tenuous. They were active participants. And the jury here was entitled to use its common sense and make inferences accordingly. Remember, this is a South Texas jury. They are familiar with the terrain. They are familiar with what has been going on in their neighborhood. The evidence supports the verdict and it must be viewed in that light. The district court also correctly enhanced Mr. Gonzalez's sentence by 6 levels. What Gonzalez did or did not do was a factual determination, as his own lawyer mentioned, or as her attorney agreed to on page 30 of the Gonzalez record. And after the government met its preponderance of the evidence burden, the district court concluded the enhancement should apply. And that finding is supported both by the facts and the law. There's no dispute that Gonzalez knew Agent Tobias was law enforcement when he started running, or shortly thereafter, that he intentionally fled, that he intentionally struggled with Agent Tobias.
They in a pile of brambly brush and thorny brush.
Exactly.
He wasn't just sort of standing around struggling. I think that's in part the origin of this shrug-shove distinction and so forth. Is that the judge is trying to look at the overall picture, and if somebody comes up and grabs someone and I just kind of go like that, that's not an assault by itself. But if you have this whole struggling and whatever, and you're this pile of brush, and then that's what can be assaultive and give rise to assaultive with the possibility of serious injury.
I think that's exactly right. And Mr. Gonzalez admitted as much that they were long thorns. At some point, I believe somebody asked him about the 2-inch, and he didn't disagree. And the judge had seen pictures, both at trial, I believe, and during sentence, about this thorny brush, which, of course, is common in South Texas.
You could put out an eye with that. If you're
exactly.
Shrugging and
exactly. And the jury.
Ms. Wilson, do you know why, if there was an assault, do you know why the government elected not to have a separate charge of assault against the defendant?
I do not, Your Honor. And Mr. Crenshaw is not even with the Southern District of Texas anymore. He's moved on to another district. So I don't know. I don't know how they charge. I get the record.
You don't
as
know
it
why
is.
They didn't charge him with an assault if they thought there was one.
No, I have no idea, Your Honor.
All right.
And sometimes we caution them not to overcharge as well. So sometimes they just, that's their decision.
Don't overcharge, but be sure and get that enhancement.
No, but Your Honor, with all due respect, I don't know. They don't consult us on charging, or I'm not consulted typically.
Well, and the burden of proof would be different. If you charged him with the crime of assault, you'd have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's exactly right.
And it's a preponderance of
but you can just get a sentence enhanced without having to prove very much of anything at all.
Well, Your Honor, I don't write the sentencing guidelines, but that's true of many guidelines.
Didn't the officer in this case say that it could have been a branch that hit him? I mean, didn't the officer say that?
Well, I have read this sentencing transcript many times. Quite frankly, I think it's difficult to follow in parts, but what he said is he didn't know. I think he was in the moment. They were struggling. He did actually say he had been shoved, but other times when he was asked a question and they used the word shrug, he agreed to that. And then when the judge starts asking a question, Agent Tobias does use the word shrug, and it cuts off, so we don't know what the rest of it is. So it's a little confusing in that regard.
But doesn't the judge ultimately conclude, and I may be wrong about this because the judge said a lot, does the judge ultimately conclude that it was a shrug and not a shove?
What the judge says is they're discussing essentially the context of an assault in general, in my opinion. And the judge says that a shove would be an assault. A shrug would be, quote, different. And she thought that's what the testimony here said, even though Agent Tobias had used the word shove. But, of course, the judge is entitled to make its finding. But she went on to say that in relation to the struggling that went on here, Agent Tobias had suffered a blow to his head that was at least caused by Mr. Gonzalez. And so the context was looking at this whole altercation, if you will. And that was how she made her finding. I don't think that the judge disregarded the law on assault at all. I don't think she said, we're just not going to apply that element. What she did say is that the sentencing enhancement should be construed broadly. And, of course, there are cases out there which were cited in the brief that resisting arrest can satisfy this particular enhancement. And so to that regard, there was evidence that applied. And so under those circumstances, Gonzalez has failed to prove any clear error. Briefly on the alternate juror argument, as this court's discussion with counsel pointed out, there is nothing in the evidence indicating that the alternate juror entered that jury room or participated in the deliberations. The only thing we have is the instruction along the lines of go deliberate. Under Rule 24C, the judge could have retained the alternate juror, waiting to see if another juror was needed, or the judge could have dismissed the alternate juror. But the record dies. We don't know what happened. But what we do know is there's nothing showing that that juror was in the room.
I just want to be sure I understand what you just said, that the judge could require an alternate juror to remain in the courthouse in some other room or whatever, just in case a juror became ill or something?
That's Rule 24C allows that. But it also, of course, allows the judge to dismiss that alternate juror. But we don't know what happened. What we do know is there's nothing indicating that the juror went in that deliberation room or came out of that deliberation room. But even assuming that had occurred, then they'd have to show an effect on their substantial rights, which all they have are conclusory statements here. And remember, this jury was out less than an hour, close to an hour, but less than an hour. That suggests to me, to the court, that the jury found this evidence very convincing here, that to convict them. So conclusory statements that somehow this tainted the process.
I mean, let me ask you this. If we had record evidence that the juror had actually gone back into the jury room with the jurors that were deliberating, are you saying they would still, for plain error purposes, have to show that that 13th person did something besides sit there?
Well, that opens up those whole line of cases which don't apply here, where a juror is in there, whether by permission, stipulation, neglect, or whatever. Some of the cases where the juror is caught, if you will, or let's say the mistake is caught, the juror is taken out and the jury is recharged and then they deliberate. And I believe those kind of cases have been upheld. In the situation where it was not caught, then that presents a different situation. For example, in Olano, there were instructions about, well, you're sitting there, but you can't deliberate. None of that occurred here. I've read those instructions very carefully. There's nothing to indicate.
No, my question is just if the record showed that the person went into the jury room,
would they have to show more than that in order to cause a reversal under a plain error review? Would
absolutely.
They have to show more than the person sitting in the room.
Right, because then if they were able to show error, they have to show the prong of that affected their substantial rights, which is what occurred in Alano, and the Supreme Court found that that wasn't enough. And here, all we're doing is speculating about would have, could have, should have. They have things along the line. I mean, they're arguing things, well, there should have been a limiting instruction, there should have been this. But that all presupposes the juror was sitting there. And quite frankly, it highlights the reasons for in jurisprudence that we require contemporaneous objections so that a district court, if a district court overlooks something or makes a mistake, can correct it and fix it, as opposed to coming up to this court and now saying you're supposed to fix it even though there's nothing in the record. And as we all know, there's ample cases that go across the whole broad spectrum of the law on that. So unless this court has any other questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson. Mr. Sullivan, you've saved time for rebuttal.
The other people behind me, so I'll be as brief as possible if that's okay with the court. Two basic concepts I thought that were important that emerged out of these various arguments. As I understand it, in the federal system, by and large, we typically don't talk much anymore about the difference between direct evidence and circumstantial evidence, and that makes good sense. Because what happens in this case is almost bizarre. We are alleging that one of these things that happened is this 13th juror, per the record, was never let go. So we are arguing that the circumstances leave that juror on there. In the same mouthful of arguing that, we have to argue that perhaps you need sometimes more than just that type of circumstantial evidence, as we sometimes argue on sufficiency matters. This might be a 2255, with all candor to the court.
The 13th juror?
Yes. We may have to have a hearing one day that trial lawyer should have gotten up and said, Your Honor, you're leaving juror number 13 on. I hope I'm making sense.
You're saying ineffective assistance of counsel.
One day.
Yeah, okay.
We might be back
there.
Well,
then tell us about what you want us to decide today.
Okay. But what I would rather you decide.
We'll look forward to your 2255.
I don't want to do the 2255.
In the meantime, we would like to hear what you have to say about today.
Yeah. No, I wanted to make that observation because we're not trying to force the court into saying that is the way. It's the only way we can see the evidence right now. And that's because we looked and we scythed the record for one little shred of evidence that says they cut him loose and it's not there. And that's why we have to bring it and leave it to the court, so to speak. The other issue was, and I agree with the court, that there was a great, thorough discussion by the judge about this difference between shrug off and shove off. From the trial court's perspective, it was a significant distinction.
But see, that wasn't all that happened. I think if that's all that had happened, then this distinction the judge made might have mattered in terms of the legal conclusion she drew. But then there's the struggle, and the struggle's in a thorny woodpile. And you could put out somebody's eye pushing and shoving and shrugging and struggling and whatever else you're doing in a thorny woodpile. And that's serious injury.
I agree. In fact, I think the argument could have been made, but the judge didn't make the argument. She argued to the contrary of that.
Said, because of the struggle, I was struck in the head by a branch. I do think we have definitive evidence that Mr. Gonzalez was struggling with the agent, resulting in the agent's blow to the head. So she's focusing on the struggle and not just the shove-shrug distinction.
And what I would say is the part before that, I think shoved him off would be the requisite finding for assault.
By itself. I mean, she didn't need, if she had found the shove, she could stop there. She went on and had a whole nother paragraph because the shrug wasn't enough. But now we have the struggle. So, I mean, again, the bottom line is, I don't think you can
use her words against her to reverse her unless it's clear that she says we don't need an assault. And I don't read that here. I read that the shrug isn't enough for an assault, but the struggle is.
And
in the context of the woodpile, et cetera, et cetera.
And please understand, Your Honor, I'm trying to find it in context. I'm not, this is a judge I think a lot of. I'm certainly not trying to push something down someone's throat. I read it because of that prior paragraph, and that's the reason I read it that way, for her to push assault out of the way and say, and I agree with the court, don't get me wrong, if you duke it out with somebody in a bunch of shrubs and thorns, you're probably going to cause some injury. It's highly likely that is assault. That's not, but ultimately that's her finding. Ultimately that's the court's finding. It is a recall, it is a request for resentencing.
And was there any injury as a result of this?
I would have to
struggle.
I don't know, and I cannot remember, Your Honor. I do apologize. I
got
can't.
A blow to the head. We know that.
We know we got a blow to the head.
Every time you're hitting people in the head,
it hurts.
Well, it doesn't just hurt. You are taking a lot of risk because heads are a very delicate thing. You have a skull, that's nice, but
I agree.
You can have all kinds of injuries, close hit,
brain damage,
head injury, and brain injury, and it's a serious thing to be blowing, hitting people in the head.
And I would also note that the thorns. You can get torn up in thorns very quickly. And that's, we certainly didn't mean to argue. So otherwise, my time is up, and I thank the court. Thank you,
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. And Mr. Sullivan and Mr. Tinoco, we noticed that you are both court appointed, and we appreciate your willingness to take the appointment. You've both done a vigorous job of representing your clients, and we hope you'll be willing to take other appointments
thank
in this
you.
Court.
Can we be excused?
Yes.